because you cannot study, you cannot look up the word faith in Liddell and Scott and discover the biblical doctrine of faith from that. You don't arrive at doctrines, biblical doctrines, from etymological. You read some commentaries really get bogged down etymologies. Works the other way. Because, for instance, Jesus used existing words but brought truth to them. Existing, these were not the consequences of life after death. You arrive at the meaning of the words in a particular context from the general teaching on that subject. That is, doctrines instruct etymologies. Etymologies do not inform doctrines. In general. Does that make sense to you?
Wake up, Mary.
Is that right?
You could repeat that next on the test, couldn't you?
Yes, I was going to say, I thought I was going to ask a question, but I just thought, I find that true when studying exegesis in Hebrew, where you have a word and go to the root, and sometimes the root doesn't make any sense. So, what would it get the meaning from that? That's the conflict.
Yeah. So, you see, really funny. Fellows write the dictionaries, you see, in the lexicons. They try to write these definitions by studying general concepts, but sometimes we use them in a bad kind of way. I think that etymological studies are useless. I'm simply saying, like cults do, and Jehovah's Witnesses do, and others, you cannot go to etymologies and establish doctrines. For instance, you cannot say this word. I'll show you an example of this. And of course, Jim, you're from Europe. Find yourself, you've gotten as much as I have, right? The antis and the instrument brethren get into endless battles on the etymology of sorrow. And it's very indecisive. Say, for instance, I've got books on my shelves and articles in my files written by our non-instrument brethren who exhaustively chase Greek roots. I have a picture. Get a picture in my mind of, you know, a fellow with these hound dogs running these Greek words to treeing them, running up the tree after them, out in every branch, and they just beat him to death. You know, this is how it was used. And then the other side do the same thing. They'll jump on their etymological horse and ride off in all directions. And the others beat the other side with these studies. And it's all very inconclusive for the simple reason that the whole approach is stupid. One of it is indecisive. Is that, number one, the point is, as whether you use musical instruments or not, was never a question with the writers of the New Testament. Never the issue. They got to choose their words with that in mind. Secondly, secondly, the Bible is not the kind of book that draws the kind of distinctions that are trying to be drawn by these etymological studies. And I find all that whole argument utterly useless, in my opinion, exceedingly ignorant. But they have a lot of fun at it, you know, let them go at it. That's like, you get the point? Same thing with Shalom. He's like a solo. The pluck doesn't mean the pluck, but then it lost that meaning. And so they try to prove doctrines of etymologies and say, my point, Jim, is this. They can have their own etymologies, but I don't want them saying when they're finished, therefore we have established what the Bible teaches. And again, they're working it backwards. First question is, does the Bible even talk about that? I found it very difficult to find the Bible teaching something it doesn't even mention or doesn't even talk about. The Bible does not talk about whether or not you should use musical instruments in a worship service or not. Got that? It doesn't talk about it. It's never the question, never an issue. Musical instruments became an issue when the Augustinian Calvinists got concerned about physical objects. They got everything physical. Lord's Supper, except four times a year, stained glass windows, idols, organs, and baptism. Just about, unless they could. That's valuable, by the way. That's the kind of thing you need to get a hold of, a concept. You're going to be a scholar. All of you are, I know. But it certainly applies to this subject, doesn't it? Is there any questions on that? Well, do not ever be drawn to that kind of argument. By the way, for instance, I would not argue as a get these endless arguments about the word bapto. It means to dip, plunge, or immerse. But they'd say, well, it also meant to wash. Sometimes you can wash by pouring. But the particular use of the word is established by the general teaching. Say burial, go down into the water. As you know from the general description of it, the metaphors involved, the symbolism, and the history of it. So that you establish, you do not fundamentally establish the practice from the meaning of the word. I'm sorry, you don't establish the mode of baptism from the meaning of the word. It's a valuable tool. It's a part of the argument, but the argument it's not how language works, you follow me? You establish the use of the word by the general practice.
I found it interesting when we went to the Holy Land with our guides. We were at one of the temple areas where it had a definite baptismal pool thing left there. And she said, I don't know what you folks believe, but she says, I don't care what they tell you, the original way of baptism was dunking.
Well, nobody ever disagreed. The only people who disagree with that are a bunch of yahoos. Everybody knows that. I mean, the Roman Catholic scholars, the Lutheran scholars, the Calvinistic scholars, most of them. Well, anyway, what I'm saying is that that the art of etymology of bapto is not valuable. I think it's instructive. I'm saying is it's not final, because that's not the way it works. Okay. Look at Hades in the New Testament, and as I've tried to point out, Hades, just as in the case of Sheol, is not always used in the same sense. Sometimes it means the state of death or the disembodied existence, Acts 2.31. And this is, we've already made reference to this. Sometimes, you will not, you neither abandon the Hades nor did his flesh suffer decay. Sometimes the word Hades carries the idea of punishment. Luke 16:23, Matthew 11:23, Matthew 23:33. I'll just mention the first one, you know this. Luke 16:23. This is the rich man and Lazarus. It says of the rich man, in Hades he lifted up his eyes being in torments. Therefore there the idea of Hades is connected with punishment, but not always. You see, the early creeds, the Apostles' Creed, which the Apostles never heard of, carries the language that Jesus descended into hell. They've tried to get away with it, they've tried to rework that recently. Jesus descended into hell. Why? Because those who wrote the Apostles' Creed assumed that the word Hades necessarily meant the idea of punishment, therefore they had Jesus in hell. Then you should hear them try to explain what he was doing there. The best thing. preaching mission. He was in hell not to go to fire. All based upon the statement about Peter, that I will leave my soul in Hades. So they made that assumption. And of course, the King James perpetuates that foolishness. The King James translates Hades as what?
Hell.
And, anyway. But that's simply cannot show that. In Old Testament, let me summarize this point, and then we'll quit for today. In the Old Testament, Sheol usually means the grave. Sometimes the place of punishment. While in the New Testament, Hades and hell usually mean that, or Hades usually means the place of punishment, but sometimes the grave. I'll sort of summarize it, taking a short cut. Get that statement. In the Old Testament, Sheol usually means the grave. Sometimes means the place of punishment. While in the New Testament, Hades usually means the place of punishment. Sometimes it means just the grave, the reverse. That's why, remember, when you asked me about this, I said they roughly correspond. They do not exactly correspond. They do not correspond in emphasis. do not correspond perfectly in focus. They roughly correspond. Did you get that statement? That's a good, helpful thing to know. It's kind of a summary, which I think is a good way to deal with things. Okay. In the Old Testament, Sheol usually means the grave, and sometimes means the place of punishment. In contrast, the words that translate it in the Greek. The New Testament, Hades, usually means the place of punishment, but sometimes just means the grave. Now, tomorrow we'll get into paradise.
Theological reason for that?
No. Except that perhaps the teaching of life after death is intensified. Paradise, term paradise, first three times in the New Testament, Luke 23:43, today you should be in paradise. 2 Corinthians 12:4. I'm just going to do that first one after you know what I'm talking about, the statement of Jesus, the thief on the cross, who foundation of Baptist theology. Good thing I think died on that cross, but that was never been when I started. Anyway, 2 Corinthians 12:4. We talk about this from another direction, talking about the possibility of a conscious state apart from the body. Paul talks about this man 14 years ago in the body, out of the body, not know, was caught up into paradise. And the third reference is Revelation 2:7. Did y'all get those three?
No.
And I won't give them once. Luke 23:43, 2 Corinthians 12:4, Revelation 2:7. And this is the in the church at Ephesus. He is near, and hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will grant to eat of the tree of life which is in the paradise of God. Paradise is an Oriental term, by the way. It meant, in the ancient Near East, it meant a pleasure park, an Oriental garden. It is spoken of as the place where Christ is now, a place where he manifests his presence and glory. Anticipates the resurrection of the body. It's simply a term. I don't think if you got there it'd be a sign welcome to paradise. Remember I said that new words are not invented? There's a very clear case where, by the way, did you see this morning? It's in one of the editorial pages. Now, where was it?
No.
It's really Rudolph Fresh, this controversial expert on writing. I read this last night. And he said he played the fallacy of going by dictionaries too much. He said, because dictionaries do not establish the meaning of the words. Use is in fact dictionary. He agreed with me, he's bound to be wise. Anyway, so this word was already there. You got that? So it's not an official label. God did not even begin the world, so I think I'll call it paradise. This is a good word. It's a common use, and it's applied to the place where those who depart go. Jim?
Said that Christ is there. I always thought he was in heaven, in paradise is where the, you know, where those who were with Abraham or those who were in their Tartarus or Hades.
Yeah. You and your mental construct. I was taught the same thing. You should forget it. We are not given categorical information. the life beyond the grave is neither explained nor defined. Jesus sits at the right hand of the Father, says that when they, I take it they're in a place we can call, it's called paradise. Again, I don't, again, this is not, I think we start compartmentalizing. We're in trouble. Says in Thessalonians letter, Jesus comes, and God will bring with him the saints, or where were they? They're with the thief. And Jesus, you shall be with me in paradise. And they are with God. They're with, we ask them, the bodies to be present with the Lord. Very clear. And think of paradise as being a location, which is more like a refugee camp with flowers, that you're in for a while, and then as soon as the judgment comes, then you move to another location. Finally, you go across the line. You know what I'm talking about? I think that's very, very scary. The Bible doesn't. What you're doing is saying, that's a mental construct formed by diagrammatically approaching the limited statements of the Bible. And we just don't know that much. You get what I'm talking about? There is this thing of, well, here's paradise, and here's the judgment, and then here's heaven. As soon as the judgment, we're going to take one step over the line, and that kind of business. Well, that may be helpful, but it certainly isn't adequate.
How do you explain the fact that in the story that Jesus told about the rich man and Lazarus, they had the lake dividing between torment and paradise?
Well, I think definitely two separate places.
They could see each other. Would you say that even after judgment that will be that way or no?
I have no idea. Probably not. I think it says death and hell are destroyed. But that would be the presence of God. I don't really know. But I do know that you don't have to wait till judgment to be with the Lord. The Bible is very clear about that. And so, in fact, he says in Revelation 2:7, if you'll him overcome, I will grant to you the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. Where's the tree of life? It's in the New Jerusalem setting in the book of Revelation. Well, I simply teach that it's the place where Christ is now, the place where he manifests his presence and glory. By the way,
I'm
sure that the idea that Christ died ascended,
you know, after he was raised, he ascended up to heaven.
And
you
were
like saying that there's a paradise down here and a paradise this way.
I'm down where
it's
under
the dirt.
That's the common idiom of the day. Again, the idiom. He uses the idiom of the day. Jesus used the common language to pretend that the content of truth. And the New Testament writers. He went to. Of course, Peter says that Jesus went and preached the spirits in prison. Commonly thought that at this time this was during the time between his death and his resurrection. And it doesn't say that. But he went there to announce something to those, probably in Jesus' time, the spirits in prison who died before the flood. Very likely that was more than half the people that ever lived in his day. Like the majority of people that ever lived in Jesus' day had died before the flood. So it's unusual that he would not ignore people who walked off and on, though, get into it. But simply to say that this term paradise is used three times to indicate the presence of Christ. If we're going to be with the Lord, where will we be? It will be a paradise. Very beautiful. And now, there may be a change of location. I don't know, at judgment. This is suggested in the book of Revelation, the new heaven and the new earth. But I'm saying all this. I think since we have very inadequate information, we're not told, we're not given a roadmap of the journey beyond the grave. I think we've got to be very careful in putting together mental constructs of it. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying they're not useful. And so maybe I'll not make them binding or defend them to the death. a question you ought to be raising, if you have questions about the question you raised, you just offer this in the back of your mind to think about, come to theology, but in what sense is Christ at the right hand of the Father, in what sense is he with us? You see, the whole theology is salvation by Christ entering the heart, actually, metaphysically entering the heart, which is the foundation of evangelical theology. How does that fit with the doctrine that he is not here? He's at the right hand of the Father making intercession for us. How do you reconcile those two doctrines? How does he dwell in our hearts? Well, the Bible says he dwells in our hearts through faith, that Christ dwells in our hearts through faith. But in what sense is the real presence of Christ with us?